just going to hear from Kevin Thomas from Students Against Sweatshops and the Makila Solidarity Network, and then we'll do questions.
For over a year now, actually about a year and a half now, students at the University of Toronto have been trying to get the university to implement the first ever code of conduct governing licensing here in Canada. And the code of conduct is designed to provide basic working standards for people producing university merchandise around the world and here at home. We've been negotiating behind closed doors with the university for about a year, and every time our task force came up with a draft of a code of conduct which we felt would provide for the basic needs of workers, we sent it on to the president and asked him to pass the code. Four times we sent it on, and four times he sent it back, asking us to study again, redraft, send him back a different copy. The last time he did that was last month. And last month he sent it back and said, remove the clause requiring companies to pay their workers a living wage. We responded with a sit-in at the U of T, which lasted 10 days in the president's office just a couple of weeks ago. The good news is that the code, well, the main demand of the sit-in was that the living wage clause be put back in and that the code be passed by the president. We ended the sit-in last Friday. On Wednesday, last night, the presidents and the vice presidents met, and at their meeting, they agreed to pass the code, and they put in a clause on living wages, which was proposed by the Students Against Sweatshops. So we finally got it passed. I'm very pleased to be able to announce that. I just heard from the vice president a couple of hours ago, and they're sending it on now to the governing council to be approved finally on May 11th, we hope. It's just one step of many, but it's very key to what Naomi has been talking about here, and that's drawing a connection between ourselves, our institutions, our clothes, our consumption patterns, and our daily lives here, and the workers, which are intimately tied to those products. The code, we hope, will become one more tool in the hands of workers, one more way that workers and their allies can actually try to improve the standards and turn around this race to the bottom on working standards. So we hope that with this code we'll be able to actually begin verification of these standards, make sure that they're being met by the corporations. We'll be able to actually campaign to get union organizers reinstated and allow freedom of association to be brought into play so the workers can bring up their own standards. And, of course, we intend to enforce the living wage clause. So I just want to share that with you, and I guess thank everyone for all the support over the last few weeks during the sit-in. The biggest and the most important part of the sit-in was that people from literally around the world supported us and sent emails and letters to the administration and talked about the issue and brought it to the forefront. So with that, I'm going to leave you with that good news and leave it to Naomi to answer questions. Thank you.
No questions.
Good evening. Part of this virgin opportunity, for instance, at U of T that corporations have to brand the whole university, I also see that the university is looking for a lot of funding that has been cut out before, and that needs to also be looked at, that it isn't as though there isn't enough money for education. It's that the Bank of Canada is not being used to borrow money interest-free. Instead, the politicians are saying, well, gee, fellas, it's a great idea. We can't afford it, but they'll spend $40 billion annually on interest rates to private banks, which are the corporations, which are tied to this branding, and so that circle goes on. But there is that complicity with the government, because we can afford in Canada to take care of our own and to be able to pay fair wages to people. It's that there is that you pull away a person's opportunity to be able to feed themselves and work. And then, of course, there's the brand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great point. What's really exciting to me about all of these examples of students and faculty finally putting their foot down and drawing a line about these corporate deals and advertising on campus is that it's not, they're not just dealing with it in isolation. I mean, it's part of this broader student movement. And what this is really about is re-engaging the debate about public education and public space in general and saying we already have a partnership between corporations and schools. It's called the tax system, and it's a great partnership. It works really well. There are no strings attached to research and the like. The deals aren't confidential, and we need to get excited about that partnership scheme again.
I'd like to base my question on your concluding remarks. You said that you felt we were just at the beginning of a struggle, and to establish, and you said the control of citizens over corporations rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. Given that corporations throughout the history of capitalism have never been had any citizen control, given that the laws of the state in virtually every country around the world, from Canada to Latin America to Asia, sanctify the rule or the existence and sanctity of corporations, given that the governments largely are in the parties are largely in the control of the corporations, do you really believe that it's possible to establish citizen control over corporations? Mm-hmm. And if so, how would this happen and what would it look like?
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be debating Marxist fundamentals this evening, but... I was the wrong thing to say in the thread. Okay, I'm sorry. I do believe that there are plenty of examples of citizens controlling corporations and that we did learn how to do it. We learned how to do it imperfectly, but we took a pretty good stab at it in the 1930s. And what this is really about is a response to the fact that the mechanisms that we fought for and won to control national corporations are meaningless in a global economy. Governments have lost their faith in themselves to control multinational corporations. And so what we need are international mechanisms and institutions to control these international corporations. And I think it can happen without full-on revolution. at least there can be a start.
I was looking for some clarification on that comment you made about people becoming brands and the mm-hmm. Tom Peters comment, the brand called you. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt people are wearing lots of brands all over the place, but I thought that what Peters was suggesting in the brand called you was that we as free agents become brands, yeah. And so David Foote is the demographics brand.
Yeah.
And ironically, I came tonight not to a title of a speech called How Brands Are Taking Over the World, but I came to see the brand called Naomi Klein.
It's not trademarked. I think that was just a joke. Was that a joke? I just want to elaborate a little bit on this, on the brand called you issue, because it's big. I mean, it's about basically the whole new economic paradigm is about self-employment and the idea of, you know, replacing stability with this idea that you can leverage your value from one short contract to the next, and that we should all be our own brand, and so on. And beyond the fact that, you know, this only actually works for the highest, most economically privileged strata of society, everybody else gets pushed down, and just it being a brand called you just means losing your benefits and doing twice as much work. You know, as I've been touring with the book, this one young woman at the University of Waterloo said, she quoted Anne Frank during the question and answer period and said that incredible quote, you know, despite everything that has happened, I still believe people are good at heart. Is that the exact quote? And she asked me whether I agreed with that. You know, it's tough not to agree with Anne Frank. And what I answered is that I do believe that people are good at heart. I don't believe corporations are people. which is why they're not good at art. I believe there are good people, really good people in corporations who work for corporations, but we've become so identified with our employers that the split of being both a citizen and an employee of a corporation, we're losing, right? And when we start talking about everybody becoming a brand called you, that is more than just about a new kind of work. It's about a new kind of citizenship. In fact, I think it's actually about the elimination of citizenship, where we are all corporations individually. So what does that mean about our ability to also be citizens? I think it has really troubling effects, especially because we know that being a brand called you does mean, just on a basic level, much longer working hours and fewer barriers between work and not work. So, okay.
Well, I wanted to congratulate you on what I thought was a very interesting expose into a new look at the way that what you talked about tonight in the form of branding is gripping society. I think that quick announcement and then a question. You raised the specter of Seattle and the spirit of Seattle in your talk as emblematic of the no logo phenomenon. And I agree with you, actually. And I also wanted to send a quick plug for people interested in going to the IMF World Bank. There are a number of organizations participating in the organization or of buses down there, and you can only copy down one phone number quickly to find out more about it, 924-9042.
By Say question,
924-9042. There are a number of different organizations involved in the fundraising for buses. It's very expensive, $3,000 per bus, but still, there's quite a lot of good work being done. My question kind of follows upon your no logo theme. My experience is working in the student movement, and I've actually seen a lot of people raising questions after Seattle that follow upon the no logo vein that actually almost veer towards the no market vein. People are starting to open up questions about how you actually pry away at restoring democracy, restoring power to citizens, and they're starting to question the whole idea of a market as something that's a human creation, a phenomenon, and how can we possibly think about unraveling either on a local level, and can we look to other examples of other ways of organizing society?
Yeah.
And I don't know, I find that very exciting and wanted to see what you thought about it.
It's definitely happening. I mean, just even the word capitalism being used again, you know. In Britain, these protests are reported on as anti-capitalism protests. It's quite astonishing and a victory in and of itself, I think. I believe that we are in this moment of flux where really what this moment is about is popular education and becoming exposed to a range of different ideas, and I think Marilyn Waring's ideas about the market are catching on more right now than they were certainly 5 years ago when she wrote the book. And there is a moment now. I think it's wonderful. My comment earlier around the limits of it, that basically there is a way that we can, just because we can't sort of completely transform the market doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to regulate it in smaller ways. I think that these two processes are very complementary.
Something that you brought up was that brands were courting backlash by the operation of their companies, what we know about sweatshop labor, environmental practices. And I just wanted to ask a little about that, because for every Talisman Energy out there, there's a company such as The Body Shop, I'm just using this as one example of many, which comes across as the environmentally friendly, socially conscious kind of company, which has co-opted a number of counterculture movements into its own little corporate identity, whether it's about the environment or it's little statements about animal rights or social justice or whatever, you know, when in fact The Body Shop is as destructive as any other company when you get closer than 100 feet away from their posters and start looking at what they really do. And I was wondering, how does the average person stay clear-headed when so much of the counterculture is incorporated in the corporate culture?
Well, see, I actually believe that this is part of the reason why there is the backlash. I believe that what particularly students at university who I've interviewed who are involved in these movements, what they're responding to is the co-optation of space, and that is intellectual and political space as well as physical space. And so, in fact, it's the companies that have been most adept at absorbing many of these ideas that have gotten hit the hardest. I mean, look at Nike. I mean, Nike markets feminism, it markets civil rights, it markets environmentalism, and it boomeranged on the company. In fact, it was these claims that made it very vulnerable. It was the fact that it was selling, you know, girl power in the West, you know, on the backs of Indonesian girls in sweatshops. And as I'm arguing, that it was not just an unfortunate incident. That's how the economy works now. So you can't actually fix it by kind of tinkering around the edges. Starbucks is the same. There's sort of a visceral response to the way Starbucks, I believe, co-opts the idea of community, progressive politics, sort of this crunchy third world chic thing they have going on at the same time as they have made very little progress on having a real code of conduct on fair trade coffee. So I don't think it works is the answer. I really don't think it works, and I don't think we should even worry about it. And I think that we should stop talking about the body shop, because it's not for every Talisman Energy there is a body shop. There's one body shop, and you know, it's a bit of an anomaly. I don't believe it is just as bad. But I think that the issue with the body shop and with Benetton, which are both in some ways unique companies, is that fundamentally what this process of branding is about is taking ideas that are precious in the culture and separating them from the reality of those ideas. So you're about environmentalism, but really it's about buying soap and bath products. Or you're against the death penalty, so buy sweaters. It's this dichotomy. And I think that what this activism, all this activism is doing is about reclaiming political activism. And I think it's happening, and so I don't think we should worry so much about the co-opting powers of capital, because I think that capital is really good at co-opting movements that are much more sort of revolution through style, revolution through rock and roll. If you think revolution is going to happen by smoking dope and, you know, using psychedelic imagery, and essentially that's why the 60s counterculture, once it already separated itself from economic issues, was so very vulnerable to marketing, and why I believe this movement isn't. And this issue keeps coming up. Carly? Oh, did Carly leave? Carly has a copy of Colors magazine, which is the magazine that Benetton puts out. Yes. Can you hold it up? It's got Mickey Mouse ears and blood on the cover. So, yes, you know, capital is very, very absorbent, and it can absorb the anti-corporate critique, and I believe it will just make this movement more militant, because I believe that what it's responding to is that type of blatant co-optation and absorbing of political ideas in public space.
Okay, I have a question, but I first want to lay down my circumstance, I guess. I'm seeing a lot in media in general, like this storyline that kind of rationalizes or normalizes really dysfunctional attitudes or like selfishness or just being really apathetic. Like it's like really cool to be apathetic and, you know, almost like anti-corporate activism has a brand is like out of fashion. It's almost, it's going to be like a brand. It's going to have its peak and then it's going to leave. And I get the feeling like a lot of ads are kind of hoping that will happen or kind of acting like, oh, okay, that's, oh, so last week. Okay, yeah. Let's stop asking about where our clothes are made from. And in some ways, I don't think that's like some big plot that's been planned by advertisers, but I see it happening and it's being nurtured. And I guess my question is, not what is the backlash? What backlashes can you imagine happening at some point in response to this? Because the only response that I want is them to obviously start changing, right? Start changing their policies, start changing the structures of corporations. But what do you think tactics they might take back in order to get a more powerful position in this kind of struggle that's going on? Like what?
The corporations.
Yeah. Like that's one technique, but I don't think they're plotting to do that. I think they're just using it. But.
Well, first of all, the main reason why I don't think it's such a threat is that I think all signs point to the fact that this movement that we're talking about is becoming much more political and less sexy, in fact, less easy to co-opt, right? That in a way, these sort of brand-based, the anti-Nike campaigns, culture jamming, were a way in. They were really a way in for young people in particular who grew up branded, grew up really mediated, to find a way into politics. But really, I mean, where it has gone is to the World Bank, you know, to the IMF, to the World Trade Organization, to APEC, to like big P, arcane, difficult, alphabet soup international politics. And I don't really see how the gap is going to go up anytime soon. So I think that the real struggle is this a brand-based consumer movement? And the only way this can become a market niche, I think, is what you're describing, is if we allow it to be about shopping. You know, to be about, like, well, I drink fair trade coffee and my shoes are vegan and, you know, whatever, right? And rather than using the brands as sort of education tools to sort of look at the global economy in miniature and not try to solve it one brand at a time, but recognize that really what this is about is the need for new rules for the global economy, and it's going to be slow and it's going to be boring at times, but you know, it's about reforming the International Labor Organization, not getting Nike to adopt a code of conduct that makes us feel better about buying Nike. So the way in which, long answer is to say, the way in which I see corporations responding is by pushing this movement to actually see it as consumer-based, right? Because the consumer-based ethos is very quick fix, right? Like, I've got a problem, can you fix it? You know, like, I want my money back. There's child labor in my, you know, sweatshirt. And these are bad political solutions. They lead to quick fix answers that are often very dangerous. That for instance, in the case of child labor, can throw children out of work in carpet factories and into prostitution if there's no plan. You know, that's the way consumers try to solve problems. They ask for a code of conduct and a guarantee and maybe a no sweat label, and that's not a joke. There are talks to have no sweat labels on clothing. So that's where I see the Nikes and the Gaps and the Levi's going. It's like, let us solve it. We'll have private codes of conduct. We'll turn it into a consumer issue. We'll give you a logo. We'll give you a badge, a guarantee, and then you'll be a niche market, you ethical people. And then we'll play it out that way. The reason why I'm not that concerned about it is because I really see the trajectory going really clearly in the other direction. And that's why you should call that number about going to Washington.
Thanks.
Okay.
Just very quickly, just sorry to set the stage first. I do a lot of work with the homeless, the working poor, a number of organizations. I organized back in 91, 92, lobbies across southwestern Ontario to lobby McDonald's to get styrofoam out of their production, a lot of things like that. At the same time, I'm a big part of Capital America. I work for one of the acrimonious three-letter acronyms that you mentioned a few times tonight.
Which one?
IBM. I'm a brand manager, actually. And my question is this. I see a marked difference between an IBM or an Ernst & Young, to a degree a Microsoft, but Amazon.com, Chapters.ca's, a lot of these companies trying to develop brand recognition, trying to develop market share and consumer awareness, versus those companies that are going to Indonesia and employing sweatshop workers, violating human and economic rights. There is a marked difference between my company or another Bay Street or Wall Street company trying to integrate, bring what we call total solutions to our customers, make it like a one-stop shop. I can help you run your business better. You don't have to go outside and, you know, search for every other little company to do every little thing. We're going to make it easier for you. Versus these other companies going, look, I can make this shoe for 20 cents by employing this worker for a quarter a day. There is a market difference there. And because of that, I don't see, quote-unquote, branding as necessarily a bad thing. Rogue capitalism and violations of international human and economic rights I see as a bad thing, but there's a marked difference between the two. I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
Mm-hmm. You know, in many ways, branding is, you know, it's just a stepped-up version of things that have been called capitalism. You know, it's not 100% new in any way. it's just become more extreme, and it goes hand in hand with deregulation and globalization. It's just another lens to see it through. But I have to say, I don't agree with you about IBM. And, you know, I believe that IBM, is, like the other companies you mentioned, is part of this shift, that many of IBM's parts are made in Indonesia, Philippines. I met workers in the Philippines who were 18 years old, were making CD-ROM drives for IBM. They said to me, I know how to make computers, but I don't think I'll ever learn how to use one. Six girls to a dorm room. I mean, I met them. And so I don't believe that IBM, I believe this is the way that business is going. I think Intel, Motorola, all the high-tech brands are going this direction, certainly for parts. And so what we're seeing is another kind of capitalism where you have these sort of super brand companies who may be good employers in some areas of their business, but they're supported by these no-brand suppliers, right, who don't ever have to sell to the public, so in many ways are immune to public pressure because they sell only to corporations. So they're totally brand-free. The contractors and subcontractors that supply the IBMs and the Nikes can get away with a lot, unless you can do what Students Against Sweatshops is doing, for instance, and make that link that they don't want made between the brand and the supplier. And that's why it's so important to get these lists. So I guess I don't see that big a difference. You know, not to say that all companies are the same, but I believe that IBM is part of this shift.
Hi. If we're into confessions, I'm not with IBM, but I am with the Canadian Action Party, which was founded 3 years to fight corporate globalization. This is probably a tough and maybe mean question, but a couple of weeks ago, Jean Chrétien, who we could say is our major corporate water boy, Mr. Logo even, talked about possibly having a fall election. And you were talking about reclaiming ourselves or our position as citizens instead of just consumers. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered what you think we as citizens can do in these pre-election months. I just want to hear what you have to say about the electoral process. It's a tough one, but we have to realize that if we're going to reclaim ourselves as citizens, and we're coming into an election year, there are roles we have to play, and if we're going to fight globalization, this is one of the ways we can do it. Mm-hmm. And I want your comments on that. Thanks.
I believe we're already doing that, and I don't think that the fact that we're going into an election year makes that much of a difference, except for that it's a good opportunity to have these debates, you know, in public about healthcare, about schools, to have the debates that we're talking about, re-energizing the debate about what it means to have public institutions, not institutions that are privatized one partnership deal at a time, and that we're seeing that process becoming politicized all over the country, and an election year is a great time to really galvanize and reframe it as a political issue. I see this happening very slowly, but I'm very encouraged by it. Like, one of the things that people are most concerned about is privatization of, people are very concerned about slow privatization of healthcare and education. And it's, with the exception of, you know, certain parts of Alberta, nobody is in favor of it. That's the strange thing in Canada. I mean, this is sort of a slow slide. It happens through attrition. And so I think that's what I would look to an election year for. Because we know the Liberals are going to win again, and worse things can happen than the Liberals winning again. So I think the real issue is getting these issues onto the agenda and having them debated in public and being a kind of unofficial opposition that the NDP isn't doing a very good job of at the moment. I think that I'm going to wrap up now because I promised to sign books. So I will be here for the next few minutes doing that. Thank you so much for coming. It was a great discussion. I had a lot of fun.